Hey Living Planet team, my name is Brian and I'm from Brazil. I love your program and I have a suggestion for your new What's Better segment. As somebody who loves both tea and coffee, I've often wondered which of the two is more sustainable. Would be great to get your thoughts on this. Thanks.
Thank you very much to Brian for that great suggestion, and that's exactly what we will be doing this week. My colleague Jennifer Collins took on the challenge, and I can tell you that she made some very interesting discoveries. So get ready for a full-blown tour of how the coffee and tea trade started and the impact it is having on our planet and societies. And of course, Brian will have his answer by the end of the programme. My name is Neil King, and this is Living Planet.
Neil, did you know that tea is actually the second most consumed drink after water in the world? And that coffee isn't actually that far behind? We drink billions of cups of these caffeinated beverages every day. How many cups do you think you drink on average a day of coffee?
Well, it's usually around 5 or sometimes 6 per day. And then, you know, in the evening, sometimes even a couple of cups of tea. So it's, a tad excessive, I know.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lot, but I'm just as bad. I'm like a massive tea drinker. I probably drink about like 5 cups a day at least. But, you know, the coffee people are always trying to get me over to their side, you know, get me onto the coffee drinking buzz, but it's not really my thing. But, you know, it really got a question brewing in my mind, and I apologise for the pun. Why are we so obsessed with these drinks in the first place? Because it's a very strange thing.
Coffee and tea are luxury goods. They're not required for us. Okay, we can survive quite happily without coffee because even though it's agricultural, if it disappeared tomorrow, people's lives would be less interesting, but their health wouldn't suddenly deteriorate. You're not losing vital vitamins. You're not losing sort of like calories or anything like that. You're just losing that edge when you need to get up in the morning because, of course, we've all got addicted to our coffee and our tea.
That's Mark Maslin, and we will come back to him later, but he's a professor of Earth System Science at University College London, which basically means that he studies
climate change in the past, the present, and the future. It allows me to look at the full system, humans, the natural environment, and how they interact. And so I stray into everything from early human evolution up to coffee.
And more importantly, he is
definitely a coffee drinker. I cannot actually function until I've had at least my first half cup of coffee.
Okay, well, that's a man after my own heart. I know it sounds like you've got some terrific questions there. Sorry about that pun, but I just had to get that in. It's a good idea that to get all the tea and coffee puns out of our system now, I guess.
Yeah, I think we really do. I'm so sorry to the listeners in advance to be putting them through this. But, you know, I have to say these questions actually kind of sent me down a bit of a rabbit hole. And, you know, I just really wanted to understand how these drinks became this integral to the daily grind of our lives. And I'm sorry, okay, that's the last pun, I promise. So let me take you back in time to the origins of coffee and tea, specifically black tea, and how they literally helped fuel
mercantile expansionism that drove the empire building, I would say, of the 17th and 18th centuries.
And in an indirect way, capitalism and climate change. So put your feet up, stick the kettle or the coffee maker on.
Yeah, okay. Let me just get another coffee and we can shoot.
Cool. We'll start with coffee. Picture this. It's the 9th century. It's late at night. There's a light breeze. The moon is shining brightly across the Ethiopian plains. And you can see the Milky Way. Your name is Kaldi, you're a goat herder, and you're struggling to stay awake. You notice that your flock are munching away on some red berries from a bush. Suddenly, the goats are full of energy. You try some yourself, and you're so exhilarated by the hit of caffeine, you run to a nearby monastery to spread the news. A monk you meet is very disapproving and throws the berries into the fire. But the gorgeous aroma of coffee wafts across the monastery and brings other monks to investigate. One genius monk rakes the roasted beans from the fire and dissolves them in hot water, and the world has its first cup of coffee. Well, that's one of the legends of the discovery of coffee from Ethiopia, which happens to be the real birthplace of the drink. The shrubs grow wild in the African country, and they were probably used by nomadic tribes for thousands of years as a stimulant. Around the 1400s, people began to realise they could roast the beans. It spread throughout North Africa and the Near East. And in Yemen, Arab Sufi monks used it to keep themselves awake during midnight prayers. Coffee then reached the Mediterranean and entered Europe in the 17th century. As more people began drinking coffee, European empires really wanted to get in on the trade.
It was taken out by the Brits, the Spanish, the Dutch to their colonies and grown. And you can really follow the history of our empires along with where coffee is grown.
That's Amy Stockwell. She's an environmental and life cycle analysis specialist, which is...
I like to liken it to calculating costs. But instead of calculating costs in euros or dollars, we calculate the cost in terms of kilograms of CO2 and other environmental impacts.
So, Neil, are you still with me or do you need another shot of caffeine?
I'm definitely still here, Jen. And we've heard a lot about coffee now. What about tea?
So, yeah, tea has mythological roots too, this time in China. And it goes back to the legendary figure Shennong, a name that roughly translates as divine farmer. He supposedly taught humans a lot of farming skills. So one day, Shennong is taking a walk through the forest, looking for some herbs and grains to eat, and he accidentally poisons himself. As he lies on the floor, convulsing in pain, a leaf from a tree just happens to fall into his mouth, and he's cured. And that was how tea and its supposed healing properties were discovered. Really though, tea leaves boiled in water have been drunk in China as a medicine for millennia. The Chinese began cultivating and processing it around the 3rd century and it later spread to Japan and other parts of Asia. The Dutch brought tea to Europe in around the 17th century, but tea was a particularly British endeavour, says UCL professor Mark Maslin. Production was...
taken from China to bring to India to actually so the British Empire could actually survive and actually survive on that tea. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's the only thing that drove the British Empire was tea production.
So former British colonies like India, Sri Lanka and Kenya are top tea producers today, partly because former British rulers expanded cultivation there. Tea drinking has become so synonymous with Britishness that one of the worst insults you can say about someone is that they're not your cup of tea. As demand for luxury goods like tea and coffee increased, global sea trade routes flourished and mercantile capitalism swept the globe. Empires including the British, Portuguese, French and Dutch expanded. They competed for colonies, raising forests and other habitats to plant cash crops with little thought for the environmental impacts, which are still being felt today. For a time, transnational corporations like the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company led these colonial adventures on behalf of their countries and ruled the waves in pursuit of profit.
So you're looking at spices, you're looking at sort of like the teas, the coffees, the things that weight for weight were more valuable than gold. Those companies had bigger standing armies than the countries. They were controlling areas larger than their home country. And they were some of the atrocities that were done underneath in terms of the pursuit of profit were appalling.
To maximize profit, empires imported slaves from Africa to work on plantations in the Americas, East Indies and the Caribbean, starting one of the darkest periods in human history, the transatlantic slave trade. 12 million enslaved Africans were shipped across the Atlantic to work the plantations from the 16th to the 19th centuries.
That was a very dark time indeed. Now, I see how coffee and tea are linked to empire and slavery, but what about climate change?
Okay, so this is where it gets a bit more complicated, but bear with me. As
empires expanded, wealth from the colonies poured into countries like Britain, where the conditions for the Industrial Revolution were starting to take shape in the 17th and 18th centuries. The larger British public were developing a taste for tobacco, tea with sugar, and coffee. These drug foods, as they're called, were unique in that they couldn't be produced locally, were easily stored, and they were really addictive. A lot of complex things were happening then to transform society, but one theory is that people started to increase their work time and decrease their leisure time, partly to pay for these habit-forming goods. This moved more of society away from subsistence agriculture. Farmers were producing bigger food surpluses. Populations began to grow really, really rapidly. Mills and factories were sprouting up all over the place to process some of the other goods coming in from the colonies, like spinning cotton into fabric. And coffee and tea all gave workers that extra jolt, helping them to toil for the long hours demanded of them. At the same time, the educated classes were coming together in coffee houses to discuss radical ideas and inventions. New technologies were improving rapidly, like the steam engine, which initially made fossil fuel coal easier to mine, and eventually led to the advent of steamboats and trains.
At the heart, I would say, of British and European society was the development of the coffee house, where people would come and actually discuss the politics of the day, philosophy, science. The great science establishments in the UK came from the coffee house. Where scientists would get together, or natural scientists, and then they went, oh, let's set up a building, let's set up the Royal Society,
By the 1840s, the Industrial Revolution began to spread to other countries. Within 40 years, it encompassed nearly all of Europe, the USA, Canada and Japan. The age of burning fossil fuels en masse had begun, and planet heating greenhouse gases in our atmosphere began to rise. The global trade routes along which coffee, tea and other goods flow were cemented, and consumer capitalism started to flourish. So Neil, after all that, we're back to the modern day. That's basically the story of how coffee and tea are so closely linked to empire, capitalism and climate change, and why they're drunk all over the world now. And I think it's really important for us to talk about that history to understand where we are now.
It is quite the story. But given that they're both such popular agricultural products, Jen, and they're transported all over the world, how much can you tell us about their environmental impact?
Yeah, so they definitely have an environmental impact. And that really brings me to the next question. That is, what is better for the environment, tea or coffee? Let's break it down.
So it's very difficult on a kilogram to kilogram level to say one's better than the other.
That's life cycle analyst Amy Stockwell again, who, by the way, is
a tea drinker. I spent 18 years working in coffee research. I love it, but I like sleeping even more.
But the reason why it's so hard to compare a kilogram of coffee beans versus a kilogram of tea is partly because with
any agricultural product, there is a huge range in variety. They're grown in different countries, the weather's different, farmers treat their crops differently. Some farms have a lot of mechanisation, some are more done by hand. So that leads to a huge range of results.
So basically, it all depends on how that tea or coffee was farmed, as well as lots of other factors that really vary from farm to farm and country to country. Which means it's really hard to make any firm recommendations, says Stockwell. But there is some research looking at the entire life cycles of both products, from cultivation and transport to consumption and waste, or cradle to grave as it's called. And that generally points to
when it comes to the tea and coffee themselves, the impact tends to come from agriculture. Of course, every farm is different again, but that tends to be where the impacts come from.
Mechanisation of tea and coffee harvesting, irrigation and the use of fertilisers which emit nitrous oxide, a powerful greenhouse gas, all contribute to the climate impact. Coffee, for instance, was traditionally planted in the shade of other trees. Now it's largely grown in huge plantations totally exposed to the sun, which requires more intensive use of water, fertiliser and pesticides. cutting forests down to make way for plantations is another major factor here.
So farmland expansion is responsible for 90% of deforestation around the world. And much of the deforestation that occurs in countries of the Global South serves to produce cash crops like coffee and black and green tea for export to the Global North, to countries of the Global North like Germany.
That's Lena Partsch, a professor of comparative politics focusing on environment and climate at Berlin's Free University. And she's...
I'm particularly interested in the regulation of global supply chains.
Part is also a
coffee addict. So I drink a lot of coffee. So I saw the average for Germans is 3 cups a day. And I think I drink more.
But back to deforestation. Tea is driving forest clearance in countries like Sri Lanka and India. But coffee's link to forest loss is particularly well documented, with around 130,000 hectares of trees vanishing each year to make way for plantations. That's according to the 2023 Coffee Barometer.
Coffee is one of the top products that cause deforestation. There's a study by Wageningen University where they estimate that 5% of deforestation can be attributed to coffee.
Once harvested, both products go into the processing stage. For tea, that involves withering, rolling, oxidation and drying. It varies for coffee, but it can include being dried, hulled, fermented and depulped. The environmental impact of this stage really depends on the kind of energy used, fossil or renewable. The next stage then is the transport from the country of origin to where the beverage is being consumed. And again, estimates for tea and coffee differ wildly here. Some studies show transport has a relatively small CO2 footprint compared to the other life cycle stages. Others show an outsized impact. Either way, fossil fuel-powered container ships and trucks do emit greenhouse gases. But one decisive factor here is whether the product is transported by sea or air. A study by Mark Maslin and Carmen Nab from UCL found transport emissions dropped from around 90% to 50% across the life cycle, with a switch from airplane to cargo ship. And packaging is another factor determining the environmental impact of these beverages. How much depends on the kind of packaging used? Is it plastic or paper made from sustainable sources? Is it recyclable? Surprisingly, packaging also has its upsides.
But we have to think about what else the packaging is doing. It's stopping the food waste, which really is the key one. Add a small amount of packaging that perhaps weighs 5 grams versus a kilogram of coffee. The 5 grams of packaging will have a much lower environmental impact. Coffee particularly needs a lot of protection from air, from oxygen, else it goes stale.
One study from the University of Quebec even found that in some cases, much derided coffee capsules could actually be better for the environment than, say, a traditional filter coffee. And that's because they cut down on water use and coffee waste going to landfill, where it rots and emits the powerful greenhouse gas methane. They recommend reusable rather than single-use capsules.
For coffee, one of the key challenges is in waste. How often do we brew an entire pot of coffee and then only drink half of it? I've seen some data in the past that said typically a third of a pot of coffee is wasted.
Okay, that brings us back to our main question. And given all the caveats, can we say that coffee or tea is better for the environment?
And can we?
Well, kind of. So one way to get an idea of how tea and coffee actually weigh up is by comparing the carbon footprint of a standard cup of each.
But if we look at a cup of tea versus a cup of coffee, and we'll keep it without milk and sugar to keep it simple for the moment.
And the winner in that case is, according to Mark and Amy, drum roll please.
Tea.
Overall, probably a cup of tea.
Well, obviously, I am absolutely delighted as a tea drinker. Vindication at last. Just joking.
But why is that?
It's basically because tea is...
so less in weight per cup.
In other words...
typically in a cup of tea, a tea bag usually has about 2 grams of tea in it. And a cup of coffee, whether it be capsule or instant or a drip filter type cup, you use about 7 grams of coffee beans. So if we were to assume that the tea versus coffee is about the same, just because we use so many more coffee beans per cup, it's likely to be that coffee has a worse environmental impact.
I see. So it really just boils down to the volume, and that less product means a lower carbon footprint.
The tea puns, Neil.
I didn't even realise there was a pun in that one. I
didn't. Boils down. but exactly. I mean, that's essentially it. But wait, there is actually more to the story here.
Then we add in milk, and we tend to add more milk to coffee rather than tea. Of course, everybody's different, but it's the milk that actually has the biggest impact. So we're at least doubling the environmental impact, sometimes trebling quite easily, especially when you go for all these really frothy, smart coffees with all sorts of exciting things on top.
And that's borne out in multiple studies. But if you're concerned about the climate impact of your tea and coffee consumption, there are lots of little changes you can make, starting with...
So only heating up the amount of water that you need is very important for tea. I always fill up the kettle more than I ought to. And of course, then I'm using all the extra electricity to heat more water than I'm going to use.
Various studies have shown that filling the kettle to capacity rather than just boiling what you need for a cup adds considerably to climate impact if your energy comes from fossil fuel sources. Other little tweaks include buying loose leaf tea instead of tea bags, which often contain plastic, and storing tea and coffee properly to help cut down on waste. If you can store coffee, for instance,
in an airtight container in the fridge or the freezer, it will stay fresh for a lot longer.
And there is one other small but very impactful change we can make.
When you have your coffee and tea, actually the biggest decision you make is what milk you put into them.
So switching to a plant-based milk or taking your coffee and tea black is one quite easy thing to do. But of course, it's not all down to consumers. Businesses, farmers, governments have a role to play too. Mark Maslin and Carmen Nab's study of coffee found that using less fertiliser, managing water and energy more efficiently, and exporting beans by cargo ship rather than plane can slash the crop's carbon emissions by around 77%. Businesses can also look for more environmentally friendly packaging and use renewable energy where possible. So Maslin added that farmers should be paid properly for their product so they can actually grow tea and coffee as sustainably as possible. Right now, farmers earn about a penny for each cup of coffee sold. And we also need to be careful that...
as our demand, our requirements, our need for coffee and tea grows, we don't then resort to deforesting new areas for that production. We look at other ways of actually increasing productivity, looking at areas that actually we can use which haven't been deforested, which have already been sort of like degraded, and we can then perhaps use that land and actually bring that up to the standard we need.
So some coffee and tea companies are already signed up to voluntary certification schemes to try to ensure their products are sustainable across their whole life cycle and come from land that hasn't been deforested. Countries have also tried including environmental conditions in international trade agreements. But supply chains are so complex, and beans and leaves often come from different sources, so it's really not easy to monitor. The European Union, though, is trying to force the issue with...
The EU deforestation regulation, which was passed last June.
That's political scientist and supply chain expert Lena Parrish again. So the new rules would cover products like cattle, cocoa, coffee, palm oil, charcoal, and companies will have to show that their products aren't from deforested land. EU consumption actually caused around 10% of forest losses between 1990 and 2020. The bloc is also trying to bring in another regulation, which would require EU companies to manage social and environmental impacts along their entire supply chain. Now, whether these regulations will actually work in practice remains to be seen, but...
enforcement now no longer depends on the voluntary choice of individual consumers, but the European Union is basically using its entire purchasing power to enforce certain standards on importers. So importers have to prove in this case, in the case of the EU deforestation regulation, that their products were not grown on deforested land.
So that kind of brings us back to where we started, right? Global trade and consumer capitalism. The thing is that the climate change unleashed by the flourishing of that trade and the beginning of the fossil fuel age is endangering our cup of tea and coffee now. Take coffee. Consumption is expected to double in the next 25 years or so. But in a world that is 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, Mark Maslin says,
the area in the world that we can map out that would be good for coffee growing halves. So that's going to be cause a huge issue when we're looking at future production.
That's because coffee is really, really fussy and needs very specific conditions to grow in.
It's a bit like us. You know, we like it nice and warm. We like a little bit of decent humidity. We don't want it too hot, sweaty, etc. Coffee's about the same, okay? I think coffee likes it a little bit warmer than humans, to give you an idea of this sort of like range.
Small farmers also do some 50% of the world's food and agricultural production. And as temperatures rise, the number of days when people can work outside will just shrink. It will simply be too hot and humid. That won't just affect the tea and coffee harvest, but other vital food sources too.
That's the greatest threat to human health, which is these people won't be able to work outside as much as they do now, and they won't be able to work at critical times when they need to harvest. That's going to affect their health, but it's also going to affect the food production and the agricultural cash coming into those communities, which is then going to affect global health.
And so the question really becomes now, how quickly can we adapt to rising temperatures? And can the world move away from fossil fuels quickly enough to stop the planet heating past 1.5 degrees Celsius or even 2 degrees? Those are the limits set by world leaders in Paris in 2015 to stop even worse damage from climate change. I mean, as Mark Maslin says, burning fossil fuel for energy was
really successful. In the 20th century, we lifted billions of people out of poverty, life expectancy grew massively, the world population doubled. So tick, tick, tick. The problem is it has a side effect, which is it then heats up the atmosphere and causes huge issues. So the problem now is how we actually go from 20th century technology to 21st century technology. And the problem is that's where the colonial legacy comes in, because there are so many vested interests from, I would say, Western countries, which are fully invested in the fossil fuel economy, that it's very difficult to break that.
So I'll leave it there, Neil, and let all that percolate.
Well, Jen, what can I say? Thank you very much. That really was super informative, and I certainly enjoyed getting the history also, both of tea and coffee at the same time. And yeah, Brian has his answer. This week's episode of Living Planet was researched and scripted by Jennifer Collins. It was edited and produced by me, Neil King, and our sound engineer was Gert Georgi. If you have any environmental dilemmas that you'd like us to look at and let you know which of the two alternatives is better, please do send us a voice message or an email outlining your problem or question, and we'll look into it for you. You can reach us at livingplanet@dw.com. And if you're enjoying the new segments we've been including in the podcast recently, why not write a short review on Apple Podcasts, or if possible, leave a rating for us wherever you get your podcasts. That's it from the Living Planet team for now. My name is Neil King. Take it easy and take care. I actually think I might go with a glass of water after all that for now.
That's probably a good idea.
No, this isn't a podcast about milk. If you like historical intrigue, a bit of culture, and a sprinkling of controversy, this one's for you. I'm Rachel Stewart, and I'm travelling around Europe, following the hidden history of everyday things as they're exported through time and around the world, by force, by chance, or by choice. No need to pack your bags. Just subscribe to Don't Drink the Milk wherever you listen to podcasts.